Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. This episode is an audio version of a virtual panel held at the Linguistics Career Launch in the summer of 2024. The video of this presentation is available at the Linguistics Career Launch YouTube channel. Links to the presentation materials and to other resources mentioned are in the show notes. This episode of Linguistics Career Cast is generously sponsored by Amazon Science. This episode is titled Refinding Your Career Path. Our three panelists, Nancy Frischberg, Emily Pace, and Laurel Sutton, that's me, share stories of their careers and the decision points that led them to their current situations. This panel emphasizes and discusses the importance of always considering your next steps and career goals as you encounter unpredictability and many unknowns throughout your life. You'll hear candid reflections about what our panelists' paths look like, what worked best for them, and how you can propel your own career forward. Topics discussed include career journey, navigating careers, precarity, intuition, personal life changes, work environment, and networking.
Well, welcome to the last full session of, or last panel, I guess, for LCL 24. My name is Nancy Frischberg. I am a career linguist. And I'll be moderating this session with my colleagues participating, Emily Pace, whom all of you have met several times, and Laurel Sutton, who's also with us. And the three of us who have been on the organizing team for this kind of event and the various other events that are being put on by Linguistics Beyond Academia, SIG of the Linguistics Society. I definitely need some tea this morning. We have been doing that for, 5 years or so, maybe a little longer. But the big ones are the LCL 21, and I hope you've seen some of those recordings. And then the one that we're having this couple weeks, LCL 24, Linguistics Career Launch for 2024. What else? I'll say one more thing about myself, and then I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves, and then we'll start asking each other questions. So let's see, my career. I have a PhD in linguistics from the University of California at San Diego. And I was the first dissertation specializing in American Sign Language topics. So that made me interesting and new. And I have since then been an academic, and I have been several other things which you will hear about in this conversation, taken on lots of funny titles. And here we are today, and thinking about careers together as a whole group. Emily, tell us about yourself.
Thank you, Nancy. Yes, so I have a master's degree in linguistics from Georgetown. I am also a career linguist, like Nancy and like many of us here. It has been such a great pleasure to be part of the leadership of the Linguistics Beyond Academia group, to be here bringing this program, particularly this year, for reasons that I think we'll be getting to in a little bit longer about why particularly this year this program has meant so much to me. I think with that, I will just turn it over to Laurel to introduce herself very, very briefly before we dive right in.
You'll be hearing so much about us and all the things that we've done. I'm Laurel Sutton. I'm one of the organizers from LCL 2021 and helping out with 2024. I have a master's degree from UC Berkeley. I am still ABD, as I say now, proudly ABD since 1998. Just didn't do it, and no regrets at all about doing that. And I've had... for a linguist, I feel like I've had a pretty stable career, but there were some twists and turns along the way, and it did not go the way that I thought it was going to go, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Cool, exactly. So I thought, so we're going to talk about unexpected changes, twists and turns, and how we've proceeded. So even though we've had all these changes, I can still give you a kind of narrative that makes sense, a through line of certain interests that I've maintained over the several different kinds of careers that I've had. But I thought a good story to start with for me is how I got out of academia. And I always say I gave myself a soft landing out of academia. So I went to grad school. I was there 3 years. I passed my qualifying exams. I had a dissertation in mind, which was not the dissertation I wrote, but I defended the proposal for that dissertation and then got offered a job in I was in San Diego, in Rochester, New York. It's quite a far distance, at a school called National Technical Institute for the Deaf, which is part of the Rochester Institute of Technology. And I got a research position in NTID with a tenure track line, pretty good. And I managed to finish my dissertation in evenings while I was working days. There are more stories about being at NTID, but we're not going to tell those today. Make an appointment. We'll talk about it. I left there after 2 years and I went to a different academic institution, Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, where there was no tenure. Everybody had contracts and they were trying, oh, look at that. Go ha camp ham, frogs. Yeah. The interesting thing about Hampshire is at the time I was there, there were things going on at on the campus, and the faculty who were older than me and had been there a couple of years more than me. The people who were, 40s and 50s were saying, we need something more solid. When I go to meetings with my other political scientists or animal behavior friends, I need to say, they say, well, have you gotten tenure yet? And we don't have that. And so we started talking about a scheme with 3 year, 6 year, and 10 year contracts. And being on that committee, I said, that sort of violates the whole idea. Let's make it a 9 year or 11 year contract or something. No, they wanted to be able to say, oh, yeah, I have a 10 year. Anyway, I left there after, well, I did what the students do. I went on sabbatical and I didn't come back, right? So I was there for 3 years, 2, 3 years, something like that. And I went to New York City and I got myself onto the grant at the National, what was it called? It was the National Center on Deafness at NYU, but it had a name. Anyway, somebody will help me remember that. And I was one of, well, they had just hired a head of the sign language research stuff, which is a guy who was a linguist, nice person, very smart, knew nothing about sign languages, but he knew a lot about language teaching, language learning, and he had spent his time in Thailand doing all that stuff. And so I said, John, you need somebody who knows more about sign languages to help you make good decisions. And he said, you're absolutely right. So I came on half time, and then I later turned into a full-time person. And there were about, I don't know, 6 or 8 deaf people there as well, and a couple more hearing people. And suddenly we started getting scrutiny from the federal government. And what happened was the director of our institute had lost the confidence of the agency, and his protector in Washington, D.C. had died, his good friend. And we realized that we didn't have any more protection in Washington and that they were going to take this grant for the rehab center away from NYU and give it to one of this director's previous grad students who had gone on to Glory and finished his dissertation, and he was working in Little Rock, Arkansas. He still is associated with the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and he still has that grant that used to be at NYU. And so what happened was all of us got laid off from the NYU place. What an interesting idea. But we didn't get laid off instantly. There were these warning signs. Three federal committees came in, zoomed in, and talked to us. And they were always interested in the work on sign language that I was doing, but that wasn't enough to hold them. There were several other projects going on under the same rehab grant, and that was the problem, some of those other projects. And so by the time we got the third committee coming through, it was pretty amazing. And I could see the writing on the wall, but I didn't know exactly how it was going to happen until we got the official letter, right? And the letter from NYU, signed by our director, said, I'm sorry to report that our federal funding has gone, and I have to send you this note that you're about to be let go in 30 days. however flowery they worded it. And so then I turned to all my deaf colleagues and they said, "You know that this is serious." And they said, "But he says to us in the verbal meetings, in the face-to-face meetings, we're going to fix it. I'm going to find a way to fix it." And I said, "Yes, but he's just sent you this 30-day notice. He ain't going to fix it." We all were gone at the end of June. And so that was what I called a soft landing, right? So then I had to think about what can I take this, what skills have I got that I can take out to the world that somebody could hire me for on a contract until I figure out what's the next real thing. And so I started selling myself in New York City, but also I was relatively well known nationally in sign language and deafness circles. And so I got jobs doing things like writing a curriculum for an interpreter training program for a different school, writing a proposal and then carrying it out for evaluating faculty who were supposed to know American Sign Language at this level to see whether they actually did reach that level. So I found ways to turn my stuff into something that I could sell. But after about 5 years, and then I did, adjunct teaching and all kinds of precarity jobs. But after about 5 years, I got hired by IBM. And so my next story, but I'll save that, is how I left IBM. So other stories of precarity or changing turns or realizations that this is not a good fit for me, or notice from the organization that you're not a good fit here anymore.
I'll jump in. Nobody died during the course of my career that caused me to change something. That's a wild story, but not unusual, right? I mean, it's all about, excuse me, who knows who, and the grant's going to people that you know, and somebody dies, and then it's just a change. So, and there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, it's completely out of your hands. I was thinking about this yesterday, and my two big unexpected career changes were when I left academia, which was because I'd been in grad school for 10 years and I was exhausted and stressed and had no money. So I had to have a job because I literally didn't have enough money to live on at that point. I wasn't funded at Berkeley at that point. Not everybody was funded. In fact, most people weren't funded. You had to pay for it yourself. So I had a couple of job options. A friend of mine worked for this naming company and said, they're looking for somebody right now, and I think you'd be a good fit. It seems like the kind of work you'd like. It wasn't doing the naming work originally. It was more like an admin position, but naming adjacent, like you'll learn how to do it. And I said, that sounds good to me. So I went and they hired me, and it was more money than I'd seen in a year in my entire life. I think this is 1997, 97, 98, and the starting salary was like $45,000, which just seemed like a giant pile of money to me at that time. And it was compared to what I'd been living on in graduate school and previous to that. So that was awesome. Did that for several years, and then left that company with a couple of my colleagues to start my own company. So that was a thing I never thought I would do, start my own company in that way. And it seemed very natural at the time, but boy, was it scary. Just thinking, we're going to leave, we're going to do our own thing, we're going to be in competition with the company we've just left. So we had to hire a lawyer and make sure it was all legal and we weren't going to get sued. Our former boss tried to sue us anyway, but that didn't go anywhere. To fund it, we had to borrow money, all three of us. Now, my two partners were MBAs and they came from middle class backgrounds. I'm strictly working class. So I asked my parents for $5,000. I asked my husband's parents for $5,000, which we paid back. It was not a gift, it was a loan because they couldn't afford to give us the money. And that's how we started it. And it was very scary, but we were successful. And that was great. And that's pretty much what I did and am still doing in my career. But the other unexpected thing that happened was a couple of years into this venture, I got divorced. And that was a good decision. Really glad that I did it because my marriage was unsustainable at that point. But I never thought that that was going to happen. Like when I got married, I thought, okay, we're going to do it. I had a kid. And getting divorced in California changes everything because it's a no-fault divorce. You split everything down the middle. And that meant that my financial situation, which had gotten pretty good, was now back to being not quite precarious, but it was different. Really, really different. And I had to think long and hard about, are we going to sell the house and split the money? Am I going to stay in the house? Is he going to stay in the house? What are we going to do with our kid? I had to start paying for daycare, which was a huge expense. There were just so many things that I had to sort out financially, and I had never thought about any of that stuff. And it really changed the trajectory of what I thought my life was going to be until now. I mean, that divorce still has had repercussions 20 some years later, that I never thought I was going to have to do. And, you know, it's one of those life changes where you can say, well, you should have seen it coming that you were going to get divorced, but you don't know, right? Like, things change. Sometimes you work it out, sometimes you can't. And it was definitely the right decision for me and for my kid, but it was a giant bomb in my life. And having spoken to on the podcast, you know, the Linguistics Career Cast, other folks have talked about their family situations. And sometimes you see it coming and sometimes you just don't. Somebody gets sick, somebody dies. You got to move for a family reason. And you just can't do anything about it. So you have to figure out how your career and your real life kind of go together and where that's going to lead you. Emily, go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I am definitely on the like career and real life train at the moment. And when we were talking, Nancy and Laurel and I yesterday about, you know, what we wanted to start off with and talking about a couple of the turns that our professional lives have taken. I'm in one now. So I've talked throughout LCL that I'm currently on a career sabbatical. I left my last position because it was no longer serving me, I guess, as some folks might term it. But I mean, it was making me really unhappy, right? Like, that's the more honest answer. And I didn't feel like I had the bandwidth to look for a new job in that sector. And I'll talk a little bit about why that was in a minute, but just feeling like I didn't know what to do next, and that the best way for me to be able to discover that was to just take a break, right? To be able to like step back from all of the stuff that I was doing, to lean into things that have given me a lot of meaning over the past years. So that's like this LCL stuff, right? And to see what comes next. I don't know what kind of a path this is, right? Am I doing a 180? Am I on a squiggle? Maybe we'll redo this panel in a year and I will know the shape of what this turn is. But there's been a couple of other things that have actually led me to get to like being on whatever shape path I'm on at the moment. The first one of which was a decision that my husband and I made to relocate from Washington, D.C. to Seattle. So we had both been there for a long time, and I had kind of mapped out this career path that I thought I would have after I got my master's degree in linguistics, and I started working for a company that was doing natural language processing services and products for federal government customers, right? So D.C. is kind of a big place for that, particularly in intelligence and defense, where most of our customers were coming from. And I had this plan that's very standard for a lot of people in the DC area of, you know, you start off at a contractor and then you move to a government job, right? You move to a government agency or a department. And that had been my plan, right? But my husband also has a career, and we decided that, you know, like things were fairly stable for me at my job, and he was happy at his job, but he'd kind of felt that he'd hit the limit of everything that he could learn from that position, and he couldn't find the type of next step that he wanted in DC. So we moved to Seattle for what was supposed to have been a 2 year like temporary relocation, right? So, and it was 2 years because that was the term that he needed to stay at that first employer, for us to not have to pay back any of the relocation package that he had been granted. And so I still had in my head, like, okay, I'm going to go to Seattle for a couple of years, like get a break from DC, enjoy the outdoors, and then we're going to move back to DC, and I'm going to pick back up with that same plan that I had. But after about a year, he was like, no, I want to stay in Seattle. I don't know. I was not on that train at that point. But we started getting close to that 2 year mark, and I was still on the I want to go back to DC see. Go back to DC camp. And then this little thing called the pandemic happened. I think, you know, either you definitely remember it or you've completely blocked it from your brain. And that made me reevaluate something hadn't necessarily considered before, but that it was very important to me during that period to be in a geographic location that took masking requirements really seriously. I can think of like a handful of times where I saw people not masked in the grocery store or whatnot. And I realized, oh, that's, I appreciate how science forward this community is. As that was going on and we were spending a lot more time in the outdoors, I was saying, oh, I think I do really like Seattle. And the final thing, to be totally honest, that made me want to stay out here was overturning Roe v. Wade, right? I am a woman who is still like well in childbearing age, and I decided that this was a place that I wanted to be, that felt important for me to stay here for like the ability to have my own bodily autonomy if I needed it. And I realized that people make all sorts of decisions around those types of like political topics, but for me, that was where I was personally. And so I, at that point, I was like, okay, I want to stay in Seattle. And that closed down that path that I thought that I could be on, right? Where like I could take my position that I'd been in for years as working as a contractor, working with these government agencies and departments, moving into working for one of them directly. Now that I'm in Seattle, that wasn't really an option anymore. And so I moved on from the company I'd been with for a long time. Not by my own volition. We actually got 3 days notice of basically like, hey, the company is effectively closing down and you're being moved to this other employer. So I was given, to Nancy's point, of a soft landing. Like we were given a life raft and we all took it. But it wound up not working out for me, for reasons of management and reasons of the work that I was doing and where I thought I could go professionally. And since that government path had, I mean, not completely closed, but the government path I thought I would be on in DC had closed for me in Seattle, and the open path for me would be working in tech. And I have been feeling somewhat ambivalent about not necessarily the role that I could play in tech, but what the tech industry looks like generally. So, reading things, reading things like Bullshit Jobs by David Graeber, which is a fabulous book, and Choke Point Capitalism by Cory Doctorow, and feeling that maybe that's not an industry that I personally want to partake in at this moment in time. And so that has led me onto the loop that I am now, right? Of like this one door closing. And I know there are open windows, and I'm still looking for them.
Emily, thank you for that candid response. The question in the doc right now is, how do you know if something is not a good fit? What are the check boxes or red flags that we should look out for? I have had this, and I have been the manager of this. Sometimes you don't get along with your manager, or your manager doesn't see the priorities the way you hope they would, or they haven't convinced you that the corporate priorities that have just been declared are the ones that we should get behind. And you see a whole bunch of things that are about to be abandoned that you worked on a lot and that you thought were actually important for the business. And so it may be both the corporate and the translation by your manager of what that means for you as an individual contributor that can cause those red flags to go off. Other responses?
So Alex put into the chat physical symptoms of stress, and for me, extremely true. A few days before I was going to put in my notice at my last position that I felt had become untenable, my husband got this like mysterious meeting set up at work. One of those things that's like maybe nothing, or maybe it's they're going to announce that they're doing layoffs. Like the end of the day Friday type of meeting, right? And so this was Thursday that he got this invite. And I was getting into bed that evening and I was kind of in a shaky mood, and I knocked over the glass of water next to the bed and it spilled everywhere, and I wound up bursting into tears and sobbing on the floor. And I realized a few days later, when it turned out the meeting was like not really anything, That maybe that wasn't a normal reaction, and maybe what was happening was that I had, committed to this plan that I was going to leave, and that was going to be the thing that was going to help improve my like physical and mental well-being. And then we were maybe going to be thrown for this loop where that wouldn't be an option, right? Because he was about to get laid off, and that all manifested in the spilling of this glass of water. And that was kind of like the final version of it. But there were a million small signs like that over the preceding 18 months that made me think like I shouldn't be doing this anymore, and made people around me think you don't seem very happy, right? And that leaving would maybe be a way to feel better about how my life was going.
Yeah, totally. I want to just tag on to that, and then I have another point. The thing that Alex says and that Emily was just talking about, listen to your gut. And there's definitely a tradition in academia, especially for women, to ignore that, right? Like we're always, it's like, oh, you're overreacting, you're being emotional, you're just putting too much emphasis on this. Take those feelings inside that don't feel good and just push them down as far as you possibly can. Just put up with it, tough it out, get through it. That's bad. Don't do that. When you start to have those feelings, however they manifest, whether it's feeling sick, being physically ill, bursting into tears, having migraines all the time, like whatever it is, listen to it and try to figure out where it's coming from. Don't ignore the gut feeling that you're having about it. The other thing, on a different note, is about work environment. And this is something I really think is under discussed, which is figuring out what kind of work environment works for you. And I mean that kind of physically and on also within a structure. So some people work really well on teams. You vibe off of it, you like working with people. Great. Some people are not good at working with teams. They're much, much better when they're working on their own and maybe have team meetings or report to one person. You're the only one who can figure out what kind of person you are. And sure, even if you're a solo worker, but you're on a team, you could manage that for a while, but maybe that's not the best long-term decision for you. And a lot of this is only stuff you figure out when you're doing it, right? Like you get out there and you're like, oh, I hate being on my own. I hate being home alone all the time working on my thing. I need to be in an office with people, or the reverse, or whatever. Some people don't do well with a 9 to 5 and they like having flex hours where they can work, noon to 9 p.m. or whatever it is. Pay attention to that stuff. The 9 to 5 thing or 10 to 6 or whatever, it's artificial. It's just, there's no reason for it to really be like that other than the convenience of capitalism. So try to pay attention to what works for you, where not only can you do it, but you can thrive doing it. And you might have the opportunity to change your work environment. Like if you don't vibe with the 9 to 5 thing, maybe you can ask and say, could I have flex hours where I can come in later and stay later? Or the reverse, like, come in earlier and leave earlier. That might be a thing. I do think it's really important to pay attention to that, because we just tend to think like, well, this is what it is and I have to put up with it. But you don't. You can look for something else, or you can try to massage what you have in order for it to be a better work environment for you to do your best work, because that's what you want to be doing.
Good. That's a good one. And I love this listen to your body stuff. And I think that's appropriate time for me to chime in here with my other story. So I left academia, or fell to my soft landing in 1980. And then in 1985, I went to dinner with some friends, and the guy looked at me and he says, you'd be good for this job. I just got offered a job today, but it's not the job for me. I said, okay, tell me about it. And I happened to have, now this is 85. I did not own a personal computer yet, I don't think, or 84, I guess. Maybe I did own a personal computer. It was a K-Pro CPM machine. You all remember that one, right? But there was no internet available for me. I barely had email. So anyway, 1984, he says this to me, and he says, do you have a resume handy? I'd love to send it in with my little note to the guy who offered me this job. I said, actually, I do, because I was about to send a proposal off to some technical institute in Minnesota. He says, "Well, you can print another one of those. Let me take the one you have and I'll send it away." So this is not the how you don't get a or the twists and this is still twists and turns. Okay, we're still good. So I gave it to him. And because of that, I got hired at IBM as the discipline specialist for the humanities. Don't you think that comes with a leather outfit and chains and stilettos and stuff like that? I mean, I really thought that, but no, it was not. There were it meant that I was the peer to the faculty in the humanities. That's the way IBM was talking about it. And so I would go on customer calls with IBM salespeople to various higher education institutions, and they knew what things cost and what equipment was available. And I knew things about how to apply the use of computers for teaching and learning, partly because I was doing amazing networking with all the other schools. So I would say to people, don't rewrite the Russian one curriculum. There are six other places that are doing that. Think about how you're going to support students at an intermediate level. What does your language lab have to be like? How can you use the computers to support people who don't really understand aspect or whatever it is, you know? Think about that stuff because then you'll be contributing to this bigger and bigger pool of digital assets. That was we were in this in between digital and analog world then. Anyway, so that was my job at IBM was network with the different higher education institutions and promote their needs back to the company. What do these humanitarians want? They asked me. Oh no. So that was because I was for the humanities, right? Okay. So that was my first job at IBM, and then when I realized somebody else, offered me a job inside the company. He says, "Do you want to go with me when I go to this next position that I'm about to take?" And I thought, "Oh my God, 18 months, I have to make a decision on what my next role is because that's the rhythm of changing roles inside that company." And so I went and talked to various people about, you know, what's a good idea? Should I follow Bob? Should I look for my own thing? What do you know about opportunities for me? I like what I'm doing now, but I don't have to just do that. And so one of my older colleagues said to me, anytime that happens to you, what you want to think about is what does that, if I take that job, what doors does that open for me? What's my next job after that? And if you can't figure out what that is, that's a good sign that it may not be an as much of a wonderful open opportunity as it sounds like, you know. But if you can figure out what the next job is and that's something you want to do, then great. That's, you know, then you're thinking two ahead. So I thought that was good advice, and I have used that as a metric to figure out which direction I want to go often. But then I took a management training job inside IBM, and I was there for a couple of years. And the point th that one we hoped was going to lead to a first line manager role within that same organization, and it would have, but I didn't want to go to Cambridge, Mass. I wanted to get away from shoveling snow. That was one of my big goals. And my partner of the time also wanted to be back on the West Coast, and we agreed that we wanted to be in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so I didn't take the Cambridge opportunity, but we found me a job inside IBM that was kind of a temporary assignment, a 2-year thing. These are my people. I found the User Interface Institute. It was amazing. And here were 40 people inside research at IBM, and they were doing user experience, but we didn't call it that then. It was human computer interaction. There was a sound bite. Oh, so promise missed that. The what my colleague said to me was, when somebody offers you a job, figure out what the job after that could be or jobs after that. So don't just think about you're being offered a management training job, but that's going to lead to a first line management position inside of the company and probably inside the smaller organization that you're in right now. So that two of those were two. There were three possible landing sites: Palo Alto, Los Angeles near UCLA, and Palo Alto. And so I was hoping for the Palo Alto. Everybody wants to go to Palo Alto. Okay, so I took, I didn't take the management job. I took a temporary position, They called it a rotational position. So it was a 2 years into research job, and then you had to find your own way out or back into research. And it was at the User Interface Institute. And so I got to learn a lot about programming and Smalltalk, although I'm not a programmer, but I was a bug finder and I could reproduce the bugs and describe the bugs. I was the demo queen for our various projects that we were doing. And so I would go out to conferences and other places and show off what we had made. And I was learning about human factors and user experience. And so at the end of my 2 year rotational assignment, we couldn't find me another position inside of research. And besides, we wanted to go to the West Coast. So I was getting ready to get laid off or to, whatever, not be assigned a manager. If you're not assigned a manager, you don't really work there. And IBM did its first layoff. But they didn't call it a layoff because IBM had a reputation of never doing layoffs. They did a RIF, reduction in force is the acronym, RIF. And how could I get myself in line to be RIFed? Well, there was a joke going around at that time because the real policy was if you can add 5 years to your age and 5 years to your years of service, and that gets you in the realm of into retirement qualifying, then you could use that and retire with those higher amounts that were associated with 5 more years of service or whatever. Then the joke was, if you can get add 5 years to your service, 5 years to your age, and if you're willing to take five managers with you, we'll give you the RIF, right? I didn't have to find five managers. But I did go and apply for a job on the West Coast. And in fact, Robin Battison recommended that I talk to this guy because Robin was also in IBM at that time. He's one of the cohort leaders. You may have seen him around. And he was a friend of mine from grad school. So Robin sent me to Frank, and I spent the whole day interviewing with Frank. But to Emily's point, I got on the airplane in New York to fly to San Jose. And all of a sudden, I burst into tears. And I thought, whoa, what's this about? I thought I wanted to go to San Jose at any cost. San Jose, Palo Alto, not so far apart. What's going on here? And I thought, well, I should be open to what Frank has to say and learn what his team is doing before I make this decision. But I guess I'm saying to myself, this isn't going to be the job for me, even just from the description that I had read. So pay attention to those bodily symptoms. That's my advice to you. I didn't take the job with Frank, and I think I probably kind of screwed myself during the interview at the very end. I was so exhausted. But anyway, didn't take that job. So what did I do next? I took the RIF and we moved to the West Coast. We had this little two-way decision tree. Either we sell our house first, or I get a new job first. We sold the house first. Yay! And so we went to the West Coast and I got a, and oh, so I had been laid off, right? And various networking things happened and I found myself as a project manager at Apple on contract. So a contingent position, but with a good view into the software division, the system software, operating system division. And that would be, I thought, this is a great way. I should be able to see where the openings are. Plus, there was a human factor, I'm sorry, human computer interaction group. It was called Human Interfaces. I can't remember the name of the group, but anyway, I would go. This was like a little affiliation group who would share work every so often, a couple of weeks, and I would sit in those sessions and learn from them and get to be a familiar. Uh-oh. Okay. Let me go back. So the last thing I'm going to say about this is I arrived at Apple the week there was a layoff, and so I got to observe all the emotions of the people who were left. And realize what a big, even though they had their job, they were still doing the same thing, no big changes, but there was a huge emotional wave going through the whole organization that was important to pay attention to, and I learned from that. Which one should we take? What piece of advice would you give to your younger self? Do you have a piece of advice? Or should we take one of these other more specific ones? Think about that one. How do you
I think I can. I think I can chime in on that one real quick. That in a lot of scenarios, people are paying less attention to you than you think. So the stakes of like that email that you're about to send aren't very high. And there's a lot of decisions available to you, but just make the one that feels right at the time, and that's kind of the best you can do.
I think I would say your career is going to be both harder and easier than you think it will be. And you will not be able to predict the ways in which it is harder and easier. Stuff that you think is going to be hard, maybe not. Stuff that you think is going to be easy, also maybe not. And you just got to roll with it. You got to be prepared for kind of anything that's going to happen.
So, and I'm going to distill one of those longer questions if I can. And so, if you're a non-traditional student in any kind of way, which might be first gen, which might be, all kinds of other things, older students, or maybe you've already got kids and you're just finishing up some degree, that those are lots of ways. How can we talk to you about the constraints that you're feeling about whether you can or can't move, and whether you, and I guess my answer is networking is your friend. I think I've said that during this conversation here. And if you know me, I'm a good networker. But even if you feel like you're a more introverted person, find others like yourself and find the people who are going to be empathetic toward your particular situation. You've got one parent who's had a stroke and the other parent's got dementia, so you can't really leave the area because none of your siblings is stepping forward, right? Networking around, and you may find I'm going to say it again. I'm sure Alex has said it six times. Read the parachute book. What color is your parachute? It's been revised every year since 1980 when it was first put out, so it's not old stuff, it's the newer stuff. And in there they talk about the hidden job market, and I think that is such a wise way to think about things. As you go around doing your informational interviews, you're going to meet people who say, there's this thing we've been trying to do, and it has to do with alphabetization, and I just don't have anybody here who can alphabetize. And you're a linguist, alphabetization, come on, that's a cinch. But keep listening, and what they may do is outline half of a job. And then what you have to do with your listening is figure out what's the other half of the job that you can bring that they never even thought they needed. If you need somebody who can alphabetize, you probably need somebody who understands categories too, right? Okay. Alex, thank you. That was good. In the chat, go ahead.
I would also say networking, absolutely, positively. Ask people for help. When you're asking people things, though, try to be specific about it. Just from my own personal experience, if someone reaches out to me on LinkedIn and they have a very specific thing, like, I am looking to get a job in X thing, or I am looking to get a job in this area, or I am looking for contract work, I find it much easier to respond to them with actionable information, or to say, hey, I can't help you, but I know somebody who can, rather than just someone coming to you and going, I'm thinking about, vague, I need a new job. Oh, okay, that doesn't help me very much. I don't know what to tell you. And it could take a long time before I can tell you something that's actually going to help you. So when you reach out to people, maximize that time that you're spending with them and ask for specific things that are suited to the person that you're talking to. If you're looking for a job at Google and you're reaching out to people at Google, that's great because that's very appropriate. They will be able to help you with it. But just don't be afraid to do it. Just ask people. And if they can't help you, likely they will put you on to somebody who can, or point you to resources. The linguistic community, to a person, has been so supportive since we've been
Yes.
doing LCL way even back in the day before it was really LCL. People want to help. And then you will too when you are having a career as a career linguist, and then you can pay it back.
And I actually think that the networking discussion takes us into another question that we have, which is about how you approach the career transition when you're not looking to move, especially if you don't have experience slash skills in the industries in your area, right? So your local network can help you figure out maybe there is a place where the skills that you have align with some aspect of your local industry that you hadn't thought of before.
Or maybe they'll be the one when they hear of an opportunity that has come up. Maybe there isn't one when you're starting your transition, but one appears later. You will be front of mind for them as somebody that who they can reach out to and pass news of that opportunity on to.
A colleague of mine taught me that she interviewed people or had informational interviews with people because she knew that at the point when there was an opening, there would be a very short timeline, and that she wouldn't be able to do a lot of broad interviewing. But she wanted to have a few candidates in her back pocket at any time, whether it was for somebody reporting to her, or if she was going to get a new management position, or her group was going to get shuffled around and part of it was going to get broken off, and they needed a new manager. So I actually got my job with that organization because of that kind of a loose interview when she didn't know quite what the next thing was going to be. But a couple months went by and she said, "My team has reorganized. I'm keeping this part, but we need somebody for this part. Are you interested?" So that worked out great.
I just want to get back real quick to that question about this point in particular, them saying we might be less receptive to taking risks, but we still have hopes and dreams. There are perhaps other constraints. Being able to write all that stuff down and being really clear on what those constraints are will be very, very helpful to you. And, we had a session about financial information last week. That's a thing that you can do. You can hook up with a financial coach or an advisor. But just having the numbers and doing the math will help you a lot to figure out what your options are. So, how much do you need to live on a month? If you're not going to move, do you want to live where you're living? Can you move to a cheaper area or something in the town where you live in or the city? How long can you be unemployed? Really and truly, how long can you be unemployed? Are you willing to take on debt? Do you have a credit card? Do you have an emergency fund? All of these things will help you with the constraints that you have. What Nancy was talking about earlier with family member, like, of course you need to take that into consideration. Realistically, what does that mean for you? You have a parent with dementia. Does that mean you're caring for them? Does that mean you visit them? Does that mean you have to contribute financially to their support? What does it mean? So the more specific you can get with what your circumstances are, the better equipped you'll be to try to find employment in a way that will work with your real life.
Yeah, and I think that's the other part of the answer to the question about approaching a career transition when you're not looking to move, right? Is you have to evaluate the situation that you're in, and you have to be really honest and explicit with yourself about what it is, right? So if you can't move or you don't want to move, that's okay. You just need to acknowledge, like, what is the career reality of the area that you're in if you're geographically constrained for some reason. And then work with that. But it is a totally valid choice to say, I'm going to pursue a career that's less prestigious or pays less or that I'm less interested in, because the thing that I need to prioritize for myself and my family is staying in a certain geographic area, right? That is a choice that many, many people make. And we talked in the work environment session that we did last week that, like, there are tons of people who love their jobs, right? But there are also a lot of people who say, this is a perfectly adequate job, and I get my meaning and pleasure in life out of, my hobbies or my side business or my family. All of those are valid options. And it's just, for you evaluating the situation and deciding what kind of life you want to have, where that life includes both your professional career stuff and everything about your personal life that you value.
Yeah. And that changes over time, right? There's going to be a point where maybe you're more focused on career, and then maybe you're married and you have a kid, or you don't, and you have to reevaluate that. It's never going to be the same. That was the big thing about getting divorced for me, was that my priorities shifted pretty radically because I thought things were going to be cool at home and there was somebody who was going to be a stay-at-home dad, and that did not happen. And so I had to quickly, very quickly, just juggle everything around to figure out how I was going to make it work in a way that worked for me and my family, but also meant that I could keep working at this company that I'd started without letting it down. And I was very honest with my partners about what my new constraints were going to be. I had to leave at a certain time every day to pick up my kid from daycare. Could not I mean, I had to. That was just the way it was. They don't keep them there after hours. They do. They charge you an exorbitant amount. So that was a new constraint, and I had to make that part of my daily work. And there were times when it was super hard, and I cried in the car as I was driving to work or from work. And it worked out in the end, but it was something that I had to deal with. My partners didn't have to deal with it, and I was very clear about what my boundaries were. To say, this is me and I have to do it this way. And if it means that I got to miss a meeting once in a while, that's just the way it's going to happen.
That's right. Well, I realize that we've run over, and because we have a lot to say, and you have a lot of questions, but I think it's getting close to cohort time for the next meetings. And so I want to thank everybody who was so attentive today, and know that you can be in touch with each of us or all of us later on, and we can expand on some of these ideas and tell you more stories.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.